What am I supposed to say?
I've never listened to a podcast.
You're listening to Big Wheel Coaching Podcast.
You're listening to Big Wheel Coaching Podcast.
A podcast. Brian McCulloch here with Big Wheel Coaching.
Hey, you're listening to Big Wheel Coaching Podcast.
Hello, and we are live for another edition of the Big Wheel Coaching Podcast. Really excited about this particular episode. I've got my lovely Joy Joy, the Big Wheel herself, joining us again. Joy, it's your podcast, and I'm just working in it. So welcome back.
No. You invited me to this podcast, so I'm glad to be here again. I've made the cut. So no, I'm excited for another episode of conversation here.
We are really excited. So for those of you who have been following our exploits recently, we went to the Tour de Big Bear. And the Tour de Big Bear is there's a bunch of Gran Fondo distances in this event. There's a 70 miler, there's a 106 miler, there's a 109 miler. It's a Gran Fondo up in Big Bear, California. It's at or above 7,000 feet. And for the long routes, it has about 10,000 feet of climbing. And the shorter routes are pretty substantial with, what was it, 5 or 6,000 feet, Joy, for this 70 mile?
No, the 70 was only 4,600. And you could, there's also the option for to do a 50 mile route and 25 and even like a 10K run. So the event's pretty cool because it caters to all levels and, you know, kind of all distances. And it's a fun village to hang out in, afterwards, or if your family or friends are coming up there and just kind of spend the weekend up out of the heat is a huge bonus. I think a lot of people really like to escape what we have down here. We call it the Inland Empire, which is a grand name for the San Bernardino County. It's hot. So a lot of people go up there and then you can kind of check out all these different distances, which is a great starting point for many people. But yeah, the 109 had, you know, over 10,000 feet of climbing. So it got pretty gnarly, pretty quick. Once people went beyond the 70 mile route.
Yeah, it got pretty gnarly, pretty quick. And so we've been doing some Gran Fondo prep rides, and those were all working towards the Mammoth Gran Fondo on September 7th. So everyone, we're trying to get a bunch of our local folks and regional folks that are big athletes and folks that just ride with us, and enjoy what we're doing. They're joining us and we're going on these rides, and we've been building towards Mammoth Gran Fondo. So a lot of us got to use the Tour de Big Bear as a preparation event. And that's really what we wanted to talk about in tonight's discussion, because prep events are so important to the coaching process, right, Joy? There's just so much that we can learn in having an event replication and having that stress and having some of those mechanical going through our equipment selections and all the things that we need to do to be able to perform really well when it comes to the big dance, whatever our big goal is. So I think it's really good to have these prep events. And we really wanted to talk through tonight, what is planning for, completing, and then debriefing about these preparation events? How does that look? What do we do as coaches? And what are we thinking of with our athletes?
Well, yeah, I think we had a unique approach here. You know, kind of both of us have not been in the thick of competition here as of late. And so, you know, for us, it was a good goal setting practice. Just be like, hey, I want to get back. And, you know, especially for myself, you know, I can't remember the last time I did, you know, maybe sometime in 2017 went and did an event like this. I think the Westlake Century, when I was probably like, I don't know, a month or two, three months pregnant, I did the Westlake Century. I did a couple centuries while I was pregnant with Samus. Anyways, that's where we're off track here. But, you know, adding in there the element of something to look forward to, or something like a little bit of the nerve started kicking in, even though I'm like, oh, I'm just doing 70 miles. You know, I've done, you know, well over 100 in the past. And, you know, I know this route really well. But I hadn't really tested myself in quite some time. And so that was one of the first things that really resonated with me, was to help encourage our clients and ourselves to, even if, you know, we don't necessarily have to go to the races and be pinning numbers on every weekend as we've done in the past, but what can we put on our horizons as coach athletes, or also, you know, help our athletes find, you know, whether it's an event, maybe it's a route that they want to do for their birthday, or something like, hey, you know, in 6 weeks time, I want to be able to do X, in this capacity. So, you know, we had that as coaches ourselves, but also we had, you know, numerous athletes up there doing the different routes. I think that we did the 70, 106 and 109. We had athletes participating in those. And so it was a good showing for Big Wheel. That's for sure.
Absolutely. And not only was it a good showing, but what I think is really important is everyone that we worked with has the opportunity to go home, debrief about it. They all had a plan going into it. They got to execute on the plan. They had to remain flexible on the plan. And then we go back and we debrief about it. And then we add the things that we need to into the training plan to continue to march towards their long-term goals, whether it be the Mammoth Grand Fondo or something like that. So I think the first place we really have to talk with everyone about is having a plan, going into these events and having something more than I'm just going to ride hard or I'm just going to see how it goes is absolutely critical. And I was really surprised because I myself got to ride the 109-mile long route. And at the front, quote unquote, front group where there was a number of riders of pro caliber and this, that, the other, I was really surprised at the number of people who hadn't looked at the route, had not looked at the elevation gain, had not looked at the weather, did not know where the stops were, didn't have, you know, enough food on them to be able to get through the ride. There was some really interesting, I would say, lack of preparation from some very skilled people. And that brought me to the question of, my goodness, I want to make sure all of our athletes never have that. And I'm really thankful to say that I don't believe any of our athletes had showed up doing that. So Joy, let's talk through a little bit of that. When we talk about having a plan and preparing for an event, again, be it 70 miles, a metric century, 100 miles, 10,000 feet, it doesn't matter. But it's really important to think through this and find out, A, all of the things that are important, but then figure out what are the metrics that matter to us. So maybe talk through that with us, Joy, and kind of how you set that table for your athletes and all of us at Big Wheel Coaching going into this.
Well, you know, I think the internet has made everything so easy for us that there's really not an excuse not to know what's in store. You know, people can get taught, yeah, it's not going to be that bad. I'm like, really? Your average altitude is 7,000 feet, you know, and many people came up from sea level, and that's, you know, you're packing a big punch. And, you know, heat at altitude or the temperature at altitude is very severe. I mean, I remember just standing around on Friday. I'm like, it just feels so hot. The sun is intense compared to even down here at 2,500 feet. And so looking at the temperatures well over 90, you know, by the end of the day, and the slower I am or the longer route I select, the more exposure time I have. You know, and I've experienced this as an athlete myself, is I'll set up a plan and then group think, that peer pressure, oh man, that can get you derailed so quickly. And that discipline can get thrown out the window very fast. And that's where, you know, there's going to be a time and a place to be like, hey, you know what, I need to stay with this group no matter what. But if there are two clicks higher, a little bit caliber above what maybe I can compete on or complete on that day, I need to be disciplined enough and really respect the plan. And that's where I think some of our athletes have gotten in trouble in the past, and myself as a rider of, you know, I've skipped aid stations when I was like, no, I'm stopping at this one. I'm stopping at this one. But I was like, oh man, I'm in this pack and we're flying, and I didn't stop. And it really jeopardized an event I was doing, you know, my performance. And so sometimes you have to learn by messing up. And, you know, you and I are very accomplished messing uppers. So, you know, that's one of the things with coaching. It's like, hey, we've made all of these mistakes and we really want to help you mitigate those and not make that mistake. You know, and sometimes you have to learn the hard way. I don't really think any of our athletes really learned the hard way at this one, but, you know, we were very diligent about, like, Let's go over the maps. Let's look at where the aid stations are placed and why or why it would not be a good idea to utilize an aid station at a certain spot on the course.
And I would go a step further. What I always go through with my athletes is I think about setting the table and why things are happening the way they are. And so we happen to know like ride promoters and event promoters, and they are just lovely people and they work super hard to bring us great events. But the fact of the matter is when they put the stops out on the route, they are not just thinking of what is best for their riders. They're thinking about what is logistically available. Where can they put this size of easy ups, tents, ice packs, chests, you know, water stops, anything of those nature. There's a lot of things that have to happen. So, you know, forgive everyone for thinking when they look at a route map and they go, oh, well, these must be the optimal places for stopping on this route. In fact, there's many layers that goes into where they put the stops, not the least of which is what is best for me as an athlete. For example, in Big Bear, there's a lot of stops at the bottom of climbs. And that seems to be a fairly common thing among a lot of these Grand Fondos. And I just have to say for those folks listening at home, plan around that. Try to plan all your stops so you're getting to the top, right? If you're getting to the top, if you need to have enough water on board and fuel on board, unless something crazy happens, to be able to get to the top of the climb. Why? Why do we do that? Well, very simply, I don't like it when I go to the ride and I stop at the bottom of the bottom of the climb. My legs get tired. They get tight. Maybe you spend a little extra time at the stop. You fuel up, you grab a bunch of extra goodies, you stuff your pockets. So your bike is heavy. You got two full bottles. You're cold. You got cold, not warmed up legs. And then you're going to start one of the most difficult sectors of the route. Usually the climbs are the more difficult sectors. So now we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot, really, by doing that. So I always encourage my athletes to think through that and plan to stop at the top of climbs when possible, as much as possible. I mean, does that seem appropriate to you, Joy? Are you having folks do that?
Well, yeah. I mean, you don't want to, have a lot of stuff on board, you know, meaning, you know, I could get to the top of the climb with one full bottle or, if I stuff my pockets, I'm probably not going to eat three bars while I'm climbing. And I know there's an aid station at the top, you know? And so for me personally, my ride time was 3:43. My pedaling time was 3:41 and a half, and my ride time was 3:43. So I stopped for a minute and a half to fill my bottles at the very top of the ride. Now, for me, a 3.5 hour ride technically is quote unquote short, you know, historically. Now you have some athletes, and especially some competitors, like if you look at the courses, if it's a 50 mile route, there are some people that are going to do that in 4 hours, you know, and so that's where I think that's where some of the decisions are for where the aid stations are. And then a rider that's going to be climbing that, it's a 7.5 mile climb to the turnaround, in the 70, that could take them an hour and a half, where me going slow took me 45 minutes. And so looking at that, then you're going to have to really work with your athlete to see, like, you know, kind of what's their pacing, what's their mile per hour, or, you know, what effort are they going to be able to put out when they get to that spot? They might need to stop at the bottom and fill a bottle and go. One of the things I've really learned to appreciate is staying with the horsepower. Meaning if I'm in a group that's rolling well, rolling quickly, I would like to stay with that group until I get to the base of the climb, if not a little ways up the climb. Then it's going to kind of, the hill kind of just makes everyone honest and they go their own pace. But when you're going in rollers or on flat sections or in descents, you're going to be so much better off with a group. And so really looking at a course, you know, I found that, you know, when I work with athletes that are doing these big Grand Fondos, I really overemphasize the importance of the flatter segments. Like the climbs are going to work themselves out, right? The descents, they're going to descend at their skill level, their confidence, or their comfort level. But if I am alone, using this event as an example from the dam all the way around, you're basically riding along a lake shoreline. And so it's rolling and flat and open and exposed. And if you did that solo, that's a huge tax on the system, and you're riding a lot slower than if you're with a group. So really planning to utilize the aid stations so that on the climbs, it's okay if I'm alone or in a small pod, but on the flatter segments, really, really, really working hard to have the fuel necessary to stay with the group.
You bring up a really good point, Joy. And not only is the group very, very powerful, but what you've alluded to and what we talked about prior to kicking off the podcast is that we wanted our folks to have a plan. And yet we wanted them to also know that we want them to be flexible with their plan. And that's really what you've highlighted in those two components of your discussion, where it's like, hey, we want to know where to stop, where we're going to do, why we're going to roll through something if we're going to, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, we also want to know how we can be flexible and how we can be creative with our planning. And by that, I mean, I should say not creative with our planning. I should say creative with our execution. Because at the end of the day, when we get out on course, in this particular case, the Tour de Big Bear, there's 2,000 athletes out there riding. They all have an influence and they all are on the road at the same time. Some of them in front of you, some of them with you, some of them behind you. Okay. And so you have to be flexible. So what Joy's saying when she says, I want to stay with the horsepower, you've been riding, let's just say the Tour de Big Bear, the Mammoth Grand Fondo, or any other event. When you're out there riding and you get caught with a group and you find yourself with a lot of momentum, if you've planned well and you know that you're good to ride on for another 15 miles without needing water or food or this or that, you can make that change. You can fully enjoy that opportunity and say, okay, I'm going to be riding down the road with this group and we're going to be flying, right? And that might take you to the next climb.
And then you're riding at a lower output anyways. You know, so I always tell people like, hey, a lot of times I'm going to make the option. I'm going to say, hey, I'm going to dig a little bit deeper so I can stay with this group. And now I'm going to be riding zone 2 at the back versus riding zone 3 by myself. You know, and that's a huge difference in load. And what I realized quite quickly, these mass start events can be really stressful for people. And you could tell very fast who was comfortable in the group and who was not. And I think that's, you know, for our athletes, I might suggest to some of them, you know, here down the line is for their upcoming events, is like, hey, you know what I think could really help you is more time and more exposure in the group, because it's not just this standalone ride where I'm out there riding 70 miles by myself. Like, that to me does not sound fun. But if you're able to, where I saw people becoming detached from the group, it probably sometimes had nothing to do with their power profile and what power they were putting out. Their heart rate was probably elevated because they were a little bit intimidated or afraid or uncomfortable in the setting. But those group riding skills, you know, we're not asking everybody to be bike racers, but I want you to be confident and competent on the bike, and so that you can stay in the group for a longer duration.
And on top of that, Joy, let's go to the very basics, where you start. So many folks, because they're intimidated of the group, they then self-select to be at the back of the group or to let everyone get a head start. And that's where I can't disagree enough with that philosophy, because I think it's so much more important to get out in front so that you have the opportunity to have clear roads. Because the rider in front, one of the most basic things about riding in a group or riding on a bicycle amongst and in and around other people is the rider in front controls the road, right? So the rider in front is going to be able to take the racing line through the corner or the smoothest line through the corner. The rider in front is going to be able to see the rocks, the potholes, the this, the that, that's going to be there that could potentially cause danger or a flat tire or, you know, a course correction, something like that. It's when you're at the back and there's all this other congestion that stress level builds because you have such little reaction time because so many people are in front of you. You then become instead of being proactive about your actions, you're being reactive. So I always encourage our athletes to start at the front, even when they don't feel that they're the most confident there. Now, I'm not saying that you should fight to be at the front at all costs. Please, there's a dichotomy in what I'm talking about here. And that is simply that we want people to be in the front because we want them to have clear road and less stress. So what I feel like you're saying, Joy, is, hey, we want you to be at the front. We want you to feel more confident in and amongst and around a high density of people, because that's going to help you be more successful and translate to better performance throughout the ride.
Right. And if you, as soon as you lose contact with the group, sometimes there's a pod forming behind you. And, you know, I had the opportunity, I started 30 minutes after the 109 group began. And so as I'm heading out, and this is, it's kind of a funny course, there's multiple turnarounds. And so as I'm heading out, I see all of the hundreds of riders from the 106 group and from the 109 group coming towards me on the opposite side of the road. So I could already see these fragments, how the group had split, how there are single riders, but then there's these bigger pods. And I'm like, holy cow, like they're like maybe 40, you know, 50 minutes into their ride. And I'm spotting so many people 100% by themselves. And if they maybe just sit up just a little bit and group with the people behind them, now, you know, two is always better than one. And then why don't we make it six? And sometimes it's, again, eating a little bit of, you know, a little bit of your pride and kind of be like, okay, I'm going to turn around. I'm going to rest for a moment and allow these four riders to catch me. And then all of a sudden around this lake where it's a flatter terrain, we're going to make up a lot of time. We're going to have a lot of traction here as a group.
And that's part of that preparation process, right? So what we wanted to tell everyone is the first things first, when you get for going for one of these preparation events, is to prepare, right? This is supposed to be a dress rehearsal for your big goal. And to make that really effective, I think the most important thing you can do is do your homework and have an idea, have a plan at the outset. But then, like you're also saying, Joy, I think it's really important. We want people to be so confident in themselves and their own skills, right, that they then are able to audible the plan and be creative with the plan and how they are executing the plan. Whether that is, you know, staying with a more advanced group until their fitness is at the limit, and then they then have the confidence to say, hey, I've had enough of this. They can then come back to a different group that is maybe more their peer level, and then they can continue to work and have a great ride because they've been fueling well. They know where the stops are. They have an idea that it might be a headwind climb or possibly a headwind descent, right? And what's interesting to me is how the wind can be so challenging in all of the folks that we work with whenever we're talking about endurance events that maybe start at 7 a.m. in the morning or earlier or later, right around then. And then they finish 5-6 hours later. We have to understand that the weather is very likely going to be different, much hotter, certainly in California, much hotter, but in other states, it's not always extremely hot like it is here in California. But there's a very good chance that there's wind direction changes out on course. And I mean, this is famous for all the folks when we used to spend a lot of time in Nevada when I was growing up, as they said, if you didn't like the weather, wait 60 minutes and it'll change, right? And that was certainly the way when I did Dirty Kansas this year. That was what they said. If you don't like the weather, just wait 60 minutes and it'll change. And so what we want people to know, yeah. So what we want people to know is that it's really important to know those things at the outset, not just because, hey, you might need different clothing, but because, for example, what we did here at the Tour de Big Bear was I brought those ice socks that we have. So those female, I guess they're not necessarily just for females, but knee-high stockings, right, that you can put ice in at the rest stop. Because we knew that we were going to start in very cool temperatures, but it was going to be very hot. So I had the good fortune of starting with about 10 of our Big Wheel Coaching athletes. And so I stuffed 10 of I brought a whole bag of them to the start because we all started at the front. And I just started handing them out to all the guys. And they had some training partners. And of course, I handed them out to them and gave them a high five. And then I kept a few extra in my pocket just for when we got to the start in case we picked up some people along the way. And the purpose of that was, hey, I want everybody to have a great performance. And after you've been exerting yourself for 4 hours and you've done 8,000 feet of climbing and you still have 2,000 feet of climbing left in, say, 20 miles or 15 miles, and then the wind direction changes, so now you're going into a downhill headwind and you have to work, oh boy, you'll be thankful to have that ice. So to me, we knew those things. We had thought about that. We've worked through that in the past. We, of course, have done that event in years past, but we've talked to other people as well about how they had an experience, what their experience was like at the event. So keep in mind that preparation isn't just using the internet and looking at the Weather Channel or whatever resources you're using and talking to your coach about pacing and rest stops and Strava files, et cetera, et cetera. That's not it. Part of it is doing some recon as well and asking your friends and training partners and maybe the guys down at your local bike shop or whoever has done the events that you're looking to do and ask them what their experience was. Because most people are very, very willing to share experiences that went really well, but also to share some experiences that didn't go so well. And we can use those things to help us be creative in what we're doing and how we are applying our efforts in our event.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's where, you know, you look at the profile or you're like, you're climbing, you're like, sweet, I've just climbed 7.5 miles, which means I get to descend 7.5 miles. And I actually worked very hard on that descent. I was by myself basically, you know, from, let's say mile 40 until the end of 70. And so, you know, that you're working, descending, into the headwind. It's pretty challenging. And that's, you know, looking again, you know, I think some of my key takeaways, and also I had the option because of being in the 70s, I saw riders from all groups. So when I loop back around, now I'm passing riders from the 50 and the 25. And then I was catching riders from the 106 and 109. And so I kind of got eyes on all levels, abilities and skill levels, which was actually quite, I was like, oh, this is, I'm doing a, like, this is a science experiment for me to see how's everybody riding. And, you know, my number one takeaway was get more comfortable in the group, as I've already said, but whatever it takes, if that means you have to kind of suck it up and go on your Saturday smash fest and learn how to ride better in a group, you're going to thank me later. Okay. The second thing is stop coasting on your bicycle. There would be countless riders and I'm like, why? I just want to get done, right? Obviously I've got to come back. I needed to find Seamus and I needed to get off my bike and be done with the ride. But I'm like, why is nobody pedaling? You know, I saw coasting after coasting after coasting and it's just not efficient. You know, you could probably take off, you know, a large percentage of time from your ride simply by pedaling your bike. And I mean, pedaling on the flats, pedaling the descent. You come up a little roller, click, grab a gear, pedal over the top and pedal down the backside. You know, just because you're coming down a small grade doesn't mean you do this big exhale and kind of slowly coast down it. Like this is a time for speed, like shift and pedal. And you're going to have a much better performance. First of all, your legs aren't going to get like all locked up and like all of a sudden you're like, oh geez, once you start pedaling again, your legs are going to hurt and it's going to be uncomfortable. And the second thing is you're just going to move faster. You're going to be more efficient. You're going to be more cardiovascularly fit by the end. And so it's really a win-win scenario if you can just keep pedaling your bike. And those are the things that just really stuck out to me. And I think the other one, we've had a lot of clients who did the event and myself, this is the first time I suffered like massive cramps. And my theory for my cramping was I'm really unfit in comparison to what I've been in the past. And I rode my bike pretty hard. And so I cramped really bad. And I've never cramped before, especially when I was fit and when I was training. And so it was like, oh, well, this is cramping and this is pretty interesting. And I had tons of electrolytes on board. And so, but a lot of our athletes were experiencing the same thing, even if their fitness levels were better or at a better spot for them. And looking again, as we spoke about earlier, the combination of that altitude and the heat, and you push yourself a little bit hard, especially in that first 20, 30 minutes, when you're with that giant group, that group think you just get sucked along. Many of our athletes mentioned or, you know, were complaining about like, holy cow, I cramped so bad and I had ingested 1 million electrolytes.
It happens so easily at altitude. And I know this from training for Tour of Utah and some of the other things. And obviously we've gotten a number of athletes that are going to the Leadville Trail 100 this weekend, the 100-mile mountain bike race, and they're going to altitude and they're going to be experiencing those things. So we certainly have a good amount of experience with preparing people for altitude events, but then doing so where they live at sea level or much lower elevations, right? And so what ends up happening and how the body reacts at altitude is quite a bit different than people really think. And that's really interesting because you think your perception, we almost have to recalibrate ourselves. And this is really the best part of downloading this with your coach and talking with your coach prior to an event. Because when we talk with anyone, let's say for those folks coming from sea level going up to 7,000 feet, it's very easy to say, hey, you're going to feel great in the morning. And in the first 10 minutes of the ride, you're going to feel like, whoa, I'm 10, 15 beats higher to do the same power output, right? Oh, I can always ride at 18 miles an hour. I should be able to go this fast on this climb. Not in the altitude, no way. And then as the heat comes on, and you alluded to something earlier, Joy, where you talked about the intensity of the heat. And the intensity of the heat is really important because it all depends on cloud cover. And when you're at high altitude, it's very easy to have zero cloud cover or all cloud cover. And when there's all cloud cover, it's very cool. But when there's no cloud cover, it feels like you're an ant under a magnifying glass and you're just being heated up and you're going to explode, right? And so it's really important for folks to know that and think through that and talk through that prior to the event so that they're appropriately calibrated when it comes to it. Because at the end of the day, I feel like the main issue, people might think that pacing themselves is just a function of I have X number of calories or I have X number of units of energy to use. And I'm going to use, you know, 2 in the first hour, 2 in the second hour, 2 in the third hour, all the way to 5 hours. And that's 10 units. And that's my 100. I'm done. Like, I'm good to go. But that's not the way it has to be, right? And being with the group far earlier into the ride allows you to reserve some of that power because you're spreading the workload amongst 1, 2, 5, 10, 20 people so that you can carry your energy much deeper into the event and not just carrying it deeper into the event, but being able to spend it when you need it, which would be in this downhill headwind you're talking about. So to come back to your particular scenario where basically from 40 miles on, you're solo, that's a totally different thing. So the energy you saved by being with the group at the front end helped you ride into that downhill headwind. It helped you pedal that extra gear over the top of the climbs and the rollers. But you had to be disciplined at the front side of it, and you had to have a plan or at least the thought that that was likely to happen. Because if you don't know that that's likely to happen, well, how can you prepare for it, right? You might have spent way too much in the beginning, and then all of a sudden, that's when this massive cramping comes on. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that your cramping is a function of lack of pacing. I'm really trying to say that you knew you were going to have to ride hard at the end of the ride, and you did, and guess what? Your body let you know about it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that it did.
You were suffering pretty bad at the end. It was, I think it was okay that I came in a little bit later because you had some time to collect yourself.
Yeah, and remembering too, since I haven't been in an event like this in a long time, just what's your post event activity, or, you know, how are you feeling? How are you taking care of yourself? And that's a lot of times we neglect that. It's a bit of an oversight with athletes because all the exciting, juicy stuff is on the ride, you know, and we're really diligent about, let's check on what are you going to eat during. And it doesn't really matter. I mean, if you're not going to go out and do another Fondo the next day, you know, your fueling can kind of be a little bit more haphazard. But what I'm more concerned about is just quality of life. You know, if you know, I end up getting a massive like altitude and exertion and heat headache. You know, and so that's something that people, you know, if they go straight to the beer garden, you know, you could be in a world of hurt, you know, if you don't grab a sandwich first or if you don't. It was awesome. They had a really good post-ride buffet, so to speak. They had like boiled potatoes. They had tons of cut fresh fruit. I think one of the U.S. Bank, I think, was up there, or like the, you know, the local U.S. Bank was providing all this stuff. But cut fruit, you had watermelons, bananas, oranges, the potatoes was a really great addition. where, you know, just little, like, you know, cutting a half, like red potato on a toothpick, you know, and that was, I grabbed, you know, two of those and you can kind of cruise by and come back and get them. They had Cokes, water, chocolate milk. And so, you know, I was able to ingest near, you know, probably, you know, 400 to 600 calories while I just come under the finishing banner. And that was a real treat, a really nice addition. Cause a lot of times you finish these events and it's like, you're in a dirt lot and you're like, man, what do I have in my cooler? Is it still cold? So really, and a lot of people too, that are like, man, I feel awful and there's no way I can eat the food. And that's where, you know, I'm not going to, the jury's out on chocolate milk for quote unquote recovery, but it's calories. You know what I'm saying? And so there kind of comes a point like I need calories in my system and sometimes liquid's better.
So hold the fort here for a second. Are you telling me there was a post-ride buffet? Cause I didn't see it. How did I miss this?
You were taking selfies under the van or with like the marching band?
Listen, I may have been searching for the bagpipe band. I may have been searching for the bagpipe band, but I was not.
You were taking pictures.
Selfies.
You were taking like FaceTime Live or whatever, like of high school, like marching band with their batons. And you missed it because there was actually a lot of really good food, free food. And it's not free, you know, and this is another thing we have to address. These events, you know, we pay good money to participate in this event. And, a lot of clients want to get their money's worth, so to speak, which means I'm going to cruise and I'm going to stop at every single aid station. And there's this buffet 5 times along the route. And in theory, and we've done this before at other events. Remember when we do these events out in Palm Desert where the aid stations are just stock full of dates because it's date country. There's literally no need to bring our own food. So they have like little Dixie cups and we fill them with the dates from the aid station. So our back pockets are just like 3 little Dixie cups full of like 7,000 calories of dates. Okay. So that I can buy into this. And then you have to respect the athlete that's like, hey, I'm here for more of an experience. I don't want to maybe necessarily hit PRs or ride super hard, but I would like to appreciate all of these things that the volunteers are working really hard to give us, you know. And the Tour de Big Bear is famous for at the base of the climb. So like you're at about mile 40, 38 to 40 at, there's an aid station, which I always neglect. I don't want to go there because it's right before the 7.5 mile climb, but they have ribs and you can stop and get barbecued ribs. And I believe the one that's like at mile 22 has chocolate dipped bacon. Okay. So you can be a total connoisseur. And there's other events where I've had clients go and they have like wine and cupcakes at each aid station, which I just can't wrap my mind around. Like I want to be doing something much, much less vigorous, preferably by a pool or hot tub in a wine and cupcake scenario.
Wine not out and in the cupcakes? Middle of
no- yeah, I think that is kind of a weird combo. Maybe it's rosé.
Did that really happen?
Yes. I think no. Maybe it was rosé. Rosé is the thing now.
What's rosé? I don't even know what that is.
You need to retract that statement and use the Google machine when you're done. Cause you just proved how uncool you are. Sidetracked looking at how we have to see what we cannot inflict onto our clients, our mission and our plan of we want to go full gas from the start. Right. So we need to really be in tune with, hey, client, what do you want out of this? What's your goal out of this? Right. You know, the cool thing about the Tour de Big Bear is that all of the entry fees go to right back into the town. All right. You're working for the Boys and Girls Club. It's going into, you know, stuff for the Humane Society up there. And there's a lot of really good charities up in Big Bear, which makes, you know, joining an event like this much more meaningful maybe than, you know, going to your local group ride or maybe even sometimes for people going to races, they want to be part of something bigger. So being able to have your entry fee go to something that's so far reaching can be really cool. And then, you know, really talking to our clients about, hey, you know, what do you want to stop and have this roving buffet of food? You know, maybe their friends are the ones at the aid station and they want to stop and say hello. And it's, I'm not going to be the one to stand between that, but now we have a plan. It's like, hey, we want to get to this aid station. And so you don't have to take much food because you're really planning on eating all the stuff that's provided for you.
And to your point, Joy, I think there's a lot of different ways to enjoy and feel like you got great value out of your entry fee. Okay. For me, I happen to think that the value is based on the experience. So the fact that I can go there and ride on closed roads, like at the Mammoth Grand Fondo, 75 miles of that are closed to cars. That's an experience we don't get in Southern California. So to me, that's where paying that entry feels very good, because now we get to use the whole road and we can utilize drafting so much better and be able to echelon in a crosswind and all these fun things. But in my mind, those are the things that the experience is what I'm there after. And so many of the folks that we really work with is, you know, they're not signing up to get chocolate covered bacon, although that is kind of like a cool value add. And by the way, I'm pretty sure that Tour de Big Bear got that from Mammoth Grand Fondo, because I happen to know the folks that actually hand dipped the chocolate last year at Mammoth Grand Fondo, but that's another story. Anyway, that being said, I think that the experience is really important. So speaking of that and having goals and being able to work through that, okay, I think it's important that once you've executed, in fact, before we go to the debrief component, Joy, I want to talk with you about being creative. We talked about being creative and flexible with executing the plan. Okay. I think we need to give folks a couple of key items to that that will help them understand what we mean by being flexible so that you can actually achieve your goals and maybe even more, or do it in a greater fashion than you knew, because we're going to use terrain to our advantage, or we're going to use the fact that we know much more about the route profile than maybe other folks do, or this or that. So I think being creative, we want to elaborate a little bit on that so that folks know what we mean by that.
Well, yeah, why don't you dig into that then?
Okay. All right. When we talk about being creative, I think about it as a dichotomy, okay? And a dichotomy means that sometimes we need to be extreme, but we also need to be able to come back to back away from that extreme. And it's really, when we think about riding or riding for performance, there's this notion that we always have to push hard and that everything has to be really challenging. And being creative in your plan and flexible in your plan is understanding that we can see many things going on in the situation, and we can see it for more than just applying the power we have. And you've already alluded to that, Joy, when we talk about knowing how to ride with a group, or maybe sitting up and going to a group behind you, right? Knowing that that will help propel you further forward down the road. Because what we're trying to do is get to the 70-mile aid station or the 50-mile aid station in the quickest possible time. So being flexible to how can I achieve that, that doesn't mean I have to ride as hard as I can from mile zero to mile 50, right? It might mean that I ride the climbs conservative and I pedal the downhills, right? And it might be, oh, wait a second, I just need to latch on to this group. And because they're all a bunch of really fast guys and gals, I don't have to do any work. They're happy to do the work for me, so I can get towed along and save my energy for mile 50 to 70, right? So I think how we apply those things are really important. And it's really going to depend on the event itself and how we apply those things. So let's talk a little bit through that and like how we thought, quote unquote, being creative when we were at Tour de Big Bear, because we just did it. And a lot of our athletes who are going to be listening today are going to be, they're going to understand what we're talking about. So let's try and break that down. What did you do creatively to help you achieve what you were trying to?
I don't know. I don't think creative. I think be crafty. Like, how am I going to, someone asked me at the start, they're like, okay, what are you doing here? And I was like, I was just out here making bad decisions to try and ride 70 miles hard. So for me, it was about self-preservation, you know, and so that creatively, it's like, hey, I know that I can't get sucked into that, you know, everyone's going full gas up the first climbs. I'm going to be creative and, allow the group to go. And that was a calculated, not really a calculated risk, but it was a plan to not, because I knew, because with my, where my lack of fitness is, had I dug really deep, specifically at altitude, 20 minutes into the ride, the wheels would have come off very badly. And I knew that things would blow apart because riders like literally just can't help themselves. And they're just dropping bombs, you know, at 7 mile mark. And if I stayed out of that fray, I could start picking them off. And so ultimately, you know, I started picking off riders as we came down a technical descent, then climbed again, caught more riders down. And then all of a sudden I'm in the front group of like 12 or 15, by being more patient. And so when I was with that group, then now I have a working group and I'm not completely smashed.
So maybe thinking creative. So if you want to call creative crafty, we're going to go with crafty, Joy. Okay. We're going to talk about crafting and maybe getting some Elmer's glue. And then, I don't know, we're going to do some scrapbooking. Like, is that what you're talking about?
No, like you're being crafty. Not like this is not the appropriate use of this term. Like, okay.
Do you mean cunning? What do you mean? Do you mean cunning? What do you mean by crafty?
sure. Cunning. Yes. Cunning. If I was to open up the Google machine, the thesaurus, then, yes, this could be a synonym for being crafty.
Okay. I think the important thing to bring in here is it's so easy in cycling to get wrapped up in the moment because cycling takes so much of your focus, and it really, especially when we're riding, at or near our maximal output or we're challenging ourselves, it's very easy to have a narrow focus. And when you have a narrow focus like that, you lose the ability to think about your long-term best interests. Okay. And that's really what we're talking about here when we're talking about being creative or being cunning or being crafty or I don't know, like underwater basket weaving, whatever kind of crafts we're talking about. Like the important component here is to help keep at least one eye, not necessarily both eyes, but one eye on the long-term plan. And the long-term plan is, let's just say in this particular case, for some of our athletes, it was getting to the top of Onyx Summit, which was about 45 miles into the ride after a significant amount of climbing. And then the Onyx Summit climb was, like you said, 7 miles into a headwind, very challenging, and went to above 8,500 feet in elevation. So the highest mark of the ride was there. You're trying to get there before 2.5 hours. So thinking through and playing the long game in my mind is, hey, we wanted to be able to get to that point as well fueled and with the minimal amount of depletion as in dehydration as possible. So what that took was having tall bottles, being disciplined about drinking early, because it's all too easy in the beginning of the ride to forget to drink because, hey, I'm just around people and maybe I just don't want to take my hands off the bars or something like that. So at the end of the day, drinking 2 bottles before 2.5 hours seems like it should just be easy because you do it on your regular training rides. We do it all the time here in Southern California, given the heat. But in that scenario, it wasn't as easy. It was much easier said than done. And right, so that's taking the short-term approach is, hey, I feel good right now. I don't need to drink. I know my coach told me to drink down these 2 bottles by 2.5 hours. Taking the long-term approach is, hey, I'm a couple of miles away from this climb starting and I still have 1 full bottle. I need to take a big swig right now and get a third of it down so that I can do the rest of the 2/3 on the 7 mile climb up to Onyx Summit. Refuel, keep going, right? So to me, I want to make sure that folks understand that what we're really saying is we want them to keep at least one eye, or at least in their mind's eye, on the long-term plan. And then obviously have fun in the moment. We're not trying to be where fun goes to die here, folks. Like, mix it up, have a good ride, tear it up, take advantage of the opportunities and the people around you. But at the same time, don't lose sight of what your long-term plan was, whether that was getting the top of the climb with a group or drinking all your fluids before you got there or eating a certain amount of calories or whatever that is. We want to make sure that folks do that. And I think that is a great example of being creative, so to speak. And I know you're not stoked on that term, so we'll work on a better term for next time.
No, that's fine. No, I think it's just, you always have to, you know, it's like if you're, I don't know, traveling somewhere, you know, driving somewhere, you have a plan, right? You have these are the stops I want to take instead of just like, oh, I need to stop there. Or, you know, hey, I have 300 miles. I'm going to fill up on a tank of gas. And that's when I'm going to let the dog out to go to the bathroom. It's the same theory. Just let's try to employ that into a ride you're doing. And a lot of people don't really think of it that way. You know, you might plan for so many areas of your life, and then when you clip into your bicycle, you're like, "Yay, let's go!" And then all things go wrong. And so looking at that, you know, if I'm going to drive to San Luis Obispo, where we have a lot of our family, I'm going to look at, you know, I'm looking at the map. What's the best way? Where can I stop? Where can I take care of Seamus? And, you know, how much snacks do I need for the drive for all of us? And so, you know, kind of saying, hey, let's indoctrinate people. Let's plan that on the bike. And, just to be diligent, not to forget that, you know, I have to get to San Luis by X time. And so I can't take all of these scenic routes. So, you know, really finding, pardon me, a real life scenario that you can help the athlete to, resonate with. And sometimes that can be the key, or like I said, sometimes they have to be like, man, I did it totally wrong this time. How do I come back and make sure? And looking too, for us, looking at our athletes, you know, I think I got to the top of the climb at 210, or no, one of my clients was 210. I was 220. And then someone else was, you know, 3 hours to the top of the climb. That's a much different fueling strategy for all those different riders. And so respecting that it might take somebody a longer time to get to that top. So even though it's 46 miles for an elite athlete, that's a much different game plan than someone who might not have that level of fitness.
And that leads us to a great point of, let's talk about debriefing afterwards, because having a plan is great. Executing that plan sometimes goes really well. Sometimes it turns out that it was a bad plan and we needed to do something different, or maybe there was things we didn't know. So always after these events, debriefing, and we do this a lot with our athletes, and I cannot stress this enough for everyone, learn something from everything you do. And so that means to me coming through, talking this out about what went well and what didn't go well, because it's very easy. There's some great sayings that no learning takes place when you win, right? But when you lose, there's plenty of lessons. Well, I'm here to tell you that there's lessons both times. It's just if we as athletes are willing to learn them, okay? If we're willing to delve into them, right? And so afterwards, when you're done with an event, and the kind of the emotion of it all has settled, whether it went really well, whether it didn't go really well, or somewhere in between, it's a great time to either through your Training Peaks account or with your coach or in your ride diary or whatever it might be, to just take a few notes on the things that went well and the things that didn't. And I always kind of like to use like three as a good starting point. Like, what three things went really well? What three things didn't go really well? And so we can talk through those things. If you have less than that, okay, great. But maybe think about it and just make sure that you really have less than that. Because sometimes there's little details that you can look at and say, oh, you know what? Man, maybe I just didn't eat enough for breakfast. And it may not have been a major issue, but it's certainly worth noting for next time, right? Like, we've talked through with a couple of our athletes when we've done our debriefs from Tour de Big Bear, where we talked through what breakfast was like. Right. And that was relative to when they were getting up in the morning. And that was even relative to when they went to bed at night. Right. Many of them went to bed late. Right. Because everybody's excited. They're up there the night before. Maybe they got into town late, so it's hard to unwind and get ready for bed. But then you have to get up extra early. So it's not as exciting to get up even earlier to make sure you can have a big breakfast for a 109-mile ride and get it digested. Right. So we've had to talk through some of those things now, although maybe it didn't affect them overly negatively, it certainly didn't make their experience better. So believe it or not, sometimes working through some of that helps you see that there's a problem somewhere else that you can easily address, i.e., hey, I need to try and arrive earlier so that I can get to sleep earlier, because, hey, light sleep is much more likely to be the case the night before an event, and especially the night before an altitude event, right? Not a lot of deep sleep taking place for folks that show up the night before an altitude event.
Well, and you know, to that point, I think it's learning too that it's okay to have a completely wacky 24 hours prior to an event, because you can get away with poor sleep hygiene that night. But looking back and like, so if the event's on Saturday, what happened on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? that's going to kind of come to fruition on Saturday. Whereas, you know, kind of the nature of the beast, you know, everyone's working hard. They're going to have to commute in. So they're either going to get up super early morning of to drive in, or they're going to cut it like late the night before, and really reassuring people like, hey, you know what? It's okay. You might feel pretty lousy on Sunday, but you're going to be able to get away with it. And let's start really prepping you the week prior, like that whole week. Let's really focus on, you know, you're kind of tapering. Let's make sure our sleep hygiene is up to par. Let's make sure you have quality nutrients coming in. We're not cutting calories at all. And that can really help. So they're confident, like, hey, I've done the work. I know I'm well fueled. I got those three really good nights sleep. And now it's a calculated risk that I know I'm going to have interrupted sleep the night prior. And it's really amazing what the body can do that next day on that short sleep. And just being like, hey, you know, I know I did the work leading into this. And I also know that I might not feel super awesome at work on Monday. I'm going to start feeling pretty tired. You know, and then too, looking for the debriefing, we have a lot of really cool metrics we can look at. Like yesterday I had open my athlete's Strava file, their Training Peaks file from this year, but also on top of that, going back and forth between his Training Peaks file from 2 years ago and kind of looking at all these comparisons. And it's really funny, not funny, haha, but it's like this gentleman had, like, looking at his Strava ride, it was top to bottom PRs on the route, but we still want more. You know what I mean? And to look like that could be 100% cups and PRs and all this jazz on Strava. Yet, and the Training Peaks, the time was faster. There's a lot of positives, but the athlete's personal sensations of the ride, like how they felt, were not on par with expectations. And that's where we can have some really great conversations. And it's really hard as an athlete to see on quote unquote paper all the bells and whistles of how awesome you're doing. But you're like, but I did not feel this is what my legs felt like. This is what my body felt like. And then we can kind of come up with a game plan on troubleshooting those sensations. Cause at the end of the day, I really trust the sensations over the PRs and the cups.
You're right, Joy. Yeah, you're definitely right there. But and kind of as you helped calibrate me on that, I would also say that sensations are very important for absolutely. And we want our athletes to be as in tune with them as possible. But also we want to recognize that we can calibrate that through the data and be able to see what really went well. So in my mind, right, like comparing the 2 years, we have to think about it from the standpoint that things were different that year. Was the wind direction different? There are any number of things that could be a reason for it. And one thing we really get into the weeds on is all the different data metrics and what they could be and how that influences and what that all turned out to be. But there's something really at the heart that is kind of both data driven and sensation driven. And I think it's really important for our athletes to understand and everyone listening to this podcast to understand the harder you go, the better you get, the suffering is there. It's going to be there. So the many people have the mistaken connection that when they start riding harder and they get more fit, that they will hurt less. And that's simply not true. Okay. So in the particular case of the athlete you're talking about, that gentleman performed extremely well, but he's now stronger. He's more experienced and he's more capable. So now he can make himself suffer and ride with another echelon better of athletes as well. So he spent a whole lot more time in the hurt locker than he did 2 years ago. But
right,
his expectation is, well, it didn't feel great. Well, yeah, man. I mean, riding at 300 watts doesn't feel particularly great, but it's very rewarding at the end of it. And so I really want to make sure for all of our folks listening at home who are our athletes and the people who are listening in and joining us who we don't coach, know that riding hard takes work. And it's not getting stronger doesn't necessarily mean you're going to suffer less. And in most cases, getting stronger just means that you can make yourself suffer more because you can do more work with less recovery. Okay. So well, you're absolutely right.
Sorry. I I'm not going to retract because I'm not that committed.
No, you're not wrong.
No.
You're not wrong.
No, but
you're not
wrong. What I was thinking,
we're bantering.
Let me say it. What I'm saying is there's a lot of situations, and I've experienced this, and I know you've experienced this as an athlete. Sometimes your best performances are obviously when you feel horrible. You know, like you're digging, like it's not going to be pretty. There's snot everywhere. Your tongue's on the top tube. You know, you literally feel like your eyes are going to pop out of your head and you're like, well, I just won. Well, like, yeah. No kidding. Look how awesome you put, look what you squeezed every drop out of your lemon. Right. And so that's where maybe I'm more talking about, like, let's talk about those sensations and then align them with the performances on the route. You know, say like, yeah, you were like X time faster on this same route and you feel this times worse. That's why. Like, look what you squeezed out of yourself. Like you went like 15 minutes faster. And the repercussion is you don't feel very good right now.
And you're absolutely right, Joy. And that was a great, well stated. I love where your head's at there. And again, you're just the best there. So in my mind, that is so important for folks to think about is that by definition, a max effort is exactly that. It's going to be painful, right? And so just for everyone at home, the only reason I brought it up was to help people see like, hey, it's not going to feel good to go super hard, right? It can still be really rewarding afterwards, but don't expect in that moment to be quote unquote pain free, right? And we see that so much when we watch the Tour de France or we watch some of these other things, these athletes look like they're not even trying, but I can tell you that they're suffering inside. They're absolutely suffering. There's no question about it. And it's really a falsehood to portray that you're not hurting, right? And then there's obviously a degree of acting that goes along with when a camera's in your face pedaling on the Tour de France because everyone can see you. And so that's part of it. So we just have to know that what we see on TV is not necessarily what we as athletes are going to experience when we're going through it ourselves. Right. When you're going for your personal best on a 7 mile climb at 8,000 feet. Yeah, that might be a little messy, but it's going to feel darn good afterwards when you look at the data and go, oh, that was rad. So yeah, good call, Joy.
Thanks, Brian. But yeah, I think, you know, I think that's a really good kind of recap and redux of getting into the Fondo Madness. And hopefully we planted a couple seeds here. I know some of our athletes are pretty jazzed to do the Mammoth Grand Fondo, which is on September 7th at, in Mammoth. And we do have a password. I'm fatigued. we have a discount code. You're not getting my password to anything. There is a discount code, to when you sign up, and it's just all caps Big Wheel. Correct, Brian?
It's Big Wheel Coaching. So capital letters, Big Wheel Coaching. When you sign up for the Mammoth Grand Fondo, use that and know that we're going to be putting together some stuff. We're going to have kind of two groups, two little Big Wheel Coaching pelotons on the road. It'll actually be one big one. We're going to get a group of folks to go under 6 hours there. And then there'll be a little group that splits off of that will then go on to maybe do like a 5:15-ish kind of ride. And so more details will come out about that on Facebook, and we'll put together a little Facebook event and things like that. So we're really excited about that. That's going to be good fun. So we know that actually a lot of people are going to be camping up there and joining us. We'll be RVing it, which will be good fun. And overall, it's going to be a great event. We'd love to have a bunch of people join us there. So if you're listening and you're interested in a great Grand Fondo, I can tell you that Mammoth is a great place to be. Yeah, we're not paid endorsers. We just really like it. Like, we just like going there. We like the people that we're around, and it's super cool to have a bunch of Big Wheel people there.
That is true. Lots of friends up there and enjoyable activities. If you're not into riding bikes all day, but you know, and one thing, we've had such great reviews and feedback, and we really appreciate all the feedback here for our podcast. You know, what would be an awesome thing to help us out is give us your feedback directly on the link. You know, we're getting a lot of it through Facebook or Instagram, but you know, right on the podcast itself, give us some feedback, give us some kudos, or, you know, click subscribe and share it. And just, we would love to get this podcast out to more people and get more people engaged in and hearing about all the fun things our athletes do and kind of, you know, our different look on a different way of addressing coaching here in the endurance world.
Love that. Oh, that's nice, Joy. You did good there. That was good. Yeah. So for everyone, thanks so much for listening. Know that this is a labor of love for us here, and we enjoy it so much, and we hope you get a lot out of it. We know a lot of you are getting a lot out of it. So, anyway, thank you guys so much for listening, and Joy, as always, you are the big wheel, so it's always awesome to talk with you, but I really always appreciate you being able to bring this stuff, bring greater color to all that we're trying to do. So, oh, you know what? We didn't do our closing gratuity. Joy, what are you thankful for?
Oh, dear. What day is it? Let's see. It's Wednesday. I'm thankful I made it through a 70-mile event alive. And this is very random. This has nothing to do with riding bikes that I'm thankful for. Today I went to Target, which is a little sketchy because it's literally the day before school starts, which I did not have a good plan for that. I did not look that up prior to going to Target. But I was checking out, and a gal I'd never seen in my entire life came up to me and gave me a compliment. And I'm not thankful for a compliment, even though everyone always likes a compliment, but the kindness of strangers was really impactful. And that was something that was like completely out of left field. You know, I was just, you know, checking my stuff out at one of the self checkers, and she came up and spoke to me and gave me a compliment. And I was like, you know what? That's A, we need more of that. And B, I was very thankful and grateful to be on the receiving end of a stranger's kindness.
Well, that's legit. That's legit. Huh. I'm gonna have to tell Coach Leo and Coach Brady, they're gonna have to step up their game. They need to be, that was next level, Joy. So,
yeah,
you know, I cannot top that because I think that's very insightful. But I just, at the moment, I happen to be very thankful for my health. I've had a rough summer of things, and actually a rough spring and summer with some riding challenges and not being able to ride that much, and only through some good physical therapy and the help of some other folks helping me get on track with some health stuff that I've been dealing with, sleep and ignoring sleep and all these other things. And so I'm very thankful to have that because I've really missed riding, and I've been able to ride a lot more, and that allows me to be with our athletes, and I just think the world of them, and I'm super, like, I just want to help them have like great experiences all the time. And so it was wonderful to be able to participate and get in the trenches with them over the weekend and ride with them and be able to make an impact there, and at least, you know, offer my help in any way that I could, whether that was a draft or a helping kind push or just offering some, hey, maybe try this, you know, this, that, the other, some coaching advice on the road. So I'm very thankful for health and being able to participate in events like this and be amongst some of the kindest people we know, or just, you know, with lovely, lovely people in there. We just happen to know them through riding bikes. So thank you for that.
Cool. No, I know everyone was stoked to have you out there. So yeah, all good things are coming together.
Love it. Well, so we hope to see everyone in Mammoth, and please, please, please just be safe, have fun, ride hard, train hard, and we will catch you guys on the next podcast. Take care.
Bye.